So we're continuing the shiur from last week, called meta-halachic field theory. Okay, and the problem is based upon the machlokas in Gittin on Nun Gimel, Daf Nun Gimel, but hezek shein enikash mehezek alash mehezek, right? Whether a damage that you can't tell, it's not visibly recognizable physically, well, that's considered damage. Okay, so the machlokas was the doraisa. Right, the example was the two examples. There's three examples. The two examples were that we use mostly were if somebody's metame your truma, right, and creates an israchilan truma for a person, for a kohen, right, or if somebody takes your wine and pours it out to a vodazara. So the wine becomes asabahana. Okay, so physically the wine is exactly the same, but halachically it becomes asabahana. You can't benefit from it. So the chokas was, is that considered nezek or not? Does he have to pay? Doraiso. In the Chagas in Chizkia and Rabbi Yochanan, I think. Okay. Yeah. So, first we tried Tzfaras, and that was the appropriate approach of trying to define, how do you define Nezek? How do you define damage? Is damage measured by loss in the value of the object? And certainly here you have loss in the value. Or does value have to really introduce like a real damage in the object, a physical damage? The object itself has been damaged, you know. And we question, why should it be that halachic changes, halachic damage, shouldn't also count? Right? In the eyes of halach, halach is real. So why shouldn't halachic change in Isra Achila, Isra Hana, also be considered nezek, right? Okay. So then we saw in the Gemara Nama Beis, the Gemara proves one side. It proves the side, Hezek Shenek or Lash Mehezek, from seemingly another sugya, okay? From the sugya of a gazlan, so somebody steals chametz, and then Pesach comes. So after Pesach, he's allowed to return the chametz, even though the chametz is asubahana. So he's allowed to give it back to the person he stole it from. He doesn't have to pay. He could say, Harei shechal fanecha, this is the bread that I took from you.
After Pesach?
Right. After Pesach, he can give him back the chametz.
It's not awesome,
Pesach, chametz, that's Avilav Pesach. All right, let's say the Rabbanan. It is a machlokas. Reb Shimon maybe holds the raisa.
Yeah,
maybe.
I think
we're maybe this price is going like Reb Shimon, and even if you say it's like Reb Yehuda, maybe it's even the Rabbana. What's the difference? Can't use it. In terms of mamonis, what's the difference?
I mean, after
Pesach,
you can use it.
There's a knas. So there's definitely a knas.
That's the Rabbanan. Which
but so what? That's the question, Doraisa, correct.
So Pesach is not
going to
be a...
Okay, fine. Okay, good. I hear the question from Pesach. But the other case was Truma. Truma becomes Tameh. Exactly the same case. No different. Okay. So Truma becomes Tameh. So you can give back the guy and say, Reshach HaFanecha. Right? We'll stick with the exact same case.
Steal Truma.
It becomes Tameh.
It becomes Tameh in my possession.
Correct.
And I say, here's your Truma.
Here's your Truma. Same as I took it. Okay.
And so you're worth a lot less now.
It's worth a lot, yeah, a lot less. It's just firewood now. Before you could have eaten it, now it's just firewood. Right? So it says Reish Chal Fanecha. So the Tosus raises the question of how you compare these two sugyas. They're not identical. They're not always. One's a sugya of Gazlan, of returning an object that he stole, and the other's a sugya of Hezek, Biadayim, when you damage something physically, your own hands. And he brings a riot from a case of where you steal an animal and you weaken it. So if you steal an animal and you beat it and you work it, overwork it till it gets skinny and it loses a lot of muscle, so then you're allowed to return it because it's basically the same object. But if you go to somebody's animal and you actually, you know, work it and you cause it to get skinny and to lose value, you have to pay him money. So you see, it could be that something could be a Maisa Hezek and you could be Chayav and Nezikin. But in terms of Gazlan, you could still return it and say, Reshach HaFanecha. So what right does the Gemara have to equate these two sugyas and prove Hezek Shenik or Lashme Hezek? In the case of Gazlan, they're just two different areas, and they have different dinim, not the same halachos. Right? That was Tosos' question. Tosos answered, is that you have to relearn, what does it mean, Hezek Shenek Alash Mehezek? He says like this, Yesh Lomer, the Kivan de Hezek Shenek or Shmeh Hezek, so if you say Hezek Shenek is Hezek, Im Kein Chashev Lek Ilu Nikr, so then we treat it like it is Nikr. V'im Kein Ein Lecha Shina Gadol Mizeh. So then you have no bigger change in the object. If Hezek Shenek or Shmehezek, then this becomes Asur Ba'ana, Asur Ba'achila. That's a tremendous change. The Kanama Gazan Bashinoi, the Gazan is Konek, because the object's totally different. So if you say it's, and then these two things follow. If you say Hezek Sheneker, Shmei Hezek, so then it becomes like it's Nicker, which is a strange thing to say. And you have no bigger change. And two things follow from that. One is you have to pay as a mazik, and two is you can't say Hezek Chafanecha, you can't return the object. So we said from this Tosos, right, is that you see, and this is the last thing we said, okay, is that the sugya is not really about nezikin. It's a more universal sugya. It's not a question about mazik, okay? Because it's really a question of vis-a-vis nezek. Everybody agrees, Rabbi Yochanan and Chizkia, both sides, Shmei Hezek and La Shmei Hezek, they both agree that vis-a-vis nezikin, in order for you to be chayav for damaging somebody's object, you have to introduce a change into the object. If you introduce a change into the object such that the object loses value, that's what we call damage, and you have to pay. The machlokus is a hezek shein nicker, a change that's not nicker, is that considered a change in the object? Is it considered that same object as it was before? The truma became tamei, nothing's, it's all the same. In which case, if it's considered the exact same object, A, you didn't damage it, by definition, because damage is a change in the object which causes it to lose value. And B, the gazan can return it because it's the same object. But if you say hezek sheneker lav shmei hezek, then, and I'm sure I did the same side twice, but if you say it's shmei hezek, so then you have to pay. It's damage. It's a new object. It's changed. It's lost value. And you can't say hezek chavanecha. And if you say lo shmei hezek, then it's completely the same. There's no damage, and you can say Hareshul Chafanecha. Okay, but the question is nothing to do with Nezikin. Nezikin demands a change in the object. The question is a Hezek Sheinik or Halachic change of Isra Hana, Isra Achila, is that considered a Shino in the object? Right, with these two Nafkaminas. That's the Machlokes. It's a much more broader universal question. Is that a Shino? Is it in the Chashino Gadol Mizeh? There's no Shino bigger than this? Or is it no, it's not a change at all? Completely different. It's the same object as before. Hareshul Chafanecha. Okay. That's where we left off last week, and now you guys had a whole week to think about it, so we're going to get as far as it's going to be amazing. Let's go. The Gemara also has a case by the Gazlan, where if you steal money, and then the Malchus, the government, devalues the money. It says we're no longer taking those dollars. You know, those it's no longer a legal form of tender, and the dollar becomes worthless. Then you could say, Reish HaKhal HaFanecha. You could still return it, because it's basically the same object to the Nigzal, the one who was robbed. Right. Yeah, correct. So, but in Hezek Sheneker, that's not a case of the Hezek, but that's a case of the Gazlan. But you see, the Gemara compares, the Brisa compares the case of stealing Truma became Tame, that you can return it, to the case where you steal a currency and the government devalues it. So that's not really a halachic change, but the Gemara compares those two things vis-a-vis, which with Tosos, we understand why it's comparing it. Because the Gemara's point is, just like when you steal...
Doesn't matter where the outside factor is coming from.
Where does it matter, exactly. Correct. They're both considered in this terms as brisa, as the object is identical. It's the same dollar. You know, it's the same truma. And the change is... Correct, yeah. Okay, so let's take one step, okay? We'll start a halachic step, and then we'll go off into the wild speculation, okay? So I say this. Is the basic question is, just a step in definition, is when you have a chaloshem, okay? Chaloshem of an isra achila, or an isra hana. Okay, which means the truman becomes tamei and you can't eat it. Or the yain nesach, yain becomes yain shis nasech avodah zarah, becomes defined. Chaloshem means like a definition, right? That's what chaloshem means. It's a definition of the object. Okay, so once the wine is engaged in this act of pouring it to avodah zarah, it becomes defined as wine that has been poured to avodah zarah, and it becomes asur bana, right? Prohibited from benefiting from it. So do we view that chaloshem, that definition, as being, as redefining the object, a redefinition of this object? It used to be regular wine, which you could drink. It used to be regular truma, which a kohen could eat. And now it's redefined as an object that you can't eat, an object that you can't be nana from. The chaloshem esrachila becomes a redefinition of the object. Okay? Or do you view that chaloshem of esrachila, of tuma, of yayin esach, of esrana, do you view that as something that's external to the object? Okay. The chaloshem doesn't redefine the object. It's something that's external to it, separate from it. You can't eat this object, but it doesn't redefine the essence of the object. Okay? If it redefines the essence of the object, it's a new object. In the Chashin and Gadamizu, it's a totally different essence. The Chaloshim is a definition, and it redefines the object. But if it doesn't redefine the object, it's the same old object. There's just this external Chaloshim, this external halacha that you can't eat it, right? So, right, the chalos is viewed somehow as being external to the object. So then it's the same object. It's just as this external isra achila, external isra hana. It's a chaloshim, but it's somehow it doesn't redefine the object. It remains, in a sense, separate from the object. Then it's the same old object. Okay? Any questions on that? Or you want me to get away with that? Okay, good. Good. That's it. Sheer over. Okay, but the question the guys are thinking about right now, they're not verbalizing well. But what does it mean? What does it mean for a chaloshim to be external to the object? Do we have any clarity, right? What does it mean it's external to the object? Or somehow it's external? If you say it redefines the object, I understand what that means. It's a redefinition, it's a new essence, I look at the object differently. But what does it mean that the chaloshim is external to the object? Right? Could we go any further in that? I mean, you could say it's a little descriptive, saying there's something external to it. But how exactly, what exactly does that mean for chaloshim to be external? Well, doesn't sound very chal, exactly. Exactly. Okay.
Well,
chal is for devolve.
Yeah, devolves upon. It's not the thing itself, it devolves upon.
So devolves upon, yeah, to devolve
chal
upon.
Chal itself is an external idea. It means it devolves upon, it's from external.
Oh, yeah, it comes from the world of chaloshemos. I know, right. I heard about this.
There you go.
And it devolves upon. The object. There you go. There you go.
Except when we say,
okay. So we're going to take half of how he spelled it. Question is, does the chaloshim inhere or in the object, or does it adhere to the object? Okay, just to get some real precise clarity here. Okay, I'm sure that makes everything much clearer. Okay? But how he's debating whether, which one is not a word? Inhere is not a word?
Inhere.
Inhere? Oh, it is a word. And adhere is a word too.
You
looked
it up?
See? It's a word.
Heard it. It doesn't mean that it's not a word.
Okay, fine. They're both words. It makes everything clear. Everybody's happy now. Okay. So try to go further in the halacha or the meta halacha, because I'm not sure how much further you're going to go in the halacha. But let's take a little break and go to physics. Okay?
Wait, so what's your spot with the
things? Oh, one more time just to repeat the thing?
Yeah, just to get the things clear.
Oh,
we go
so
to
the question
waters.
Is, does the chaloshim of Tumma and Isra Achila, does it inhere in the object? Meaning, it redefines the object. It's a new object. Okay? And therefore, in the Chashina Gadol Mizu, it's totally different. Can't return it. And therefore, it's considered Hezek. It's a change that devalues it. Or do you say that the Chaloshim adheres to the object? It's something external. It sticks to it in a certain sense, whatever adhere means. And therefore, the object fundamentally has remained the same. It has this Chaloshim, but the object is essentially unchanged, and therefore you could say Reish L'chaf and Echad Gazlan, and there's no Nezek because the object hasn't undergone a change.
Just like the king flooding the market with new currency and devaluing.
Yeah, right.
How can you give a new definition to a thing without changing the thing?
No, you're right. If you redefine it, it's changed.
Right.
But if you say Bechal Hashem doesn't redefine it, it just makes it also Bechila. But fundamentally, it's the same object.
So
it's grain, it's wheat, it's grain, it's truma, but the Isra Achila is not redefining as an object that's also Bachila. It's just somehow external.
Like a status it has.
An external type of status.
So the question is,
yeah,
is
right.
It Shinar Hashem or not?
Shinar Hashem.
I like it. Shinar Hashem is a little different. It's a different figure. You know that's from Ruba. No, I guess what would be the category? Would the category be Shinar Hashem?
Right, you're saying you change the definition, change the shame, and Shinar Hashem?
I don't know whether it'd be made. I mean, it can't be Shinar Maisa, right? I guess it'd be Shina Hashem. I don't know. I guess so. Probably. That seems right. What else could that be? I'll go with that. Okay, fine. So this is the physics. So I'm not sure how many guys you're familiar with. I'm just going to try to keep it classical physics. Okay. So I hope everybody knows what an electron is. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So, well, okay, fine. So electrons are charged particles. Okay. So we're going to talk about particles first as particles. So particles are little things, little tiny little things, okay? And they could have charges, and this is the original way to look at it. Einstein called this the mechanical view, okay? The mechanical view. So when you look at it, the mechanical view views the world as made up of little particles, little tiny objects. And these objects have certain properties. Okay? One of these properties is called charge. Now, what happens when I have two charged particles? So if they're like charge, they have the same charge, okay, we can make up terms for them called negative. Okay? Let's say they're both negative. Okay? An electron, two electrons have the same charge, they're both negative. So then two like charges, they'll repel each other. Okay? The closer they get, the more they will repel each other. Okay? And if they're opposite charges, like a proton and an electron, then they will attract each other. And the closer they get, the more they will attract each other. Right? It's a function of how big each charge is, how much charge each particle has, which you could put some sort of number on. Okay? Where that number comes from is a different question. And the distance, it's a function of distance. Right? The further apart they are, and it has to be distance squared, okay, but the further apart they are, the weaker the force one feels exerts on the other. Right? And the closer they are, the stronger it is. So as they get really close, right, this is how magnets work also. Magnets actually work through the same type of force. Okay? So I have one way to look at it is I have these particles and they have this charge. And the force they exert on each other to either repel or attract each other is a function of the distance between the two. Okay? And that's the mechanical view of the universe. Okay? Particles with forces acting between particles based upon the distance, the separation they have from each other. So far, so good? Yeah, go ahead.
Is the number or strength of the charge one of these mystical constants?
Yeah. Exactly. But that's a different problem for a different time. Okay.
The book is in progress.
Because of what?
The book is in progress.
It's still in progress. Okay, good. Now, what developed was... I'm not sure if this idea is going to be important at all. You know, we'll see if it becomes. Or it might not be important at all, okay? It's important, it might not be relevant at all to this year, but it is important, is that in the mechanical view of things, it's action at a distance, okay? In a sense, one charge, let's say the charges are, you know, 100 meters apart from each other, okay? So if I move one, let's say I take one and I move it, physically move it, so the force it exerts on the other one is going to decrease, it's going to be a little less because it's further away, and say move them apart from each other, okay? But in a sense, if you look at in this picture of the world, it's instantaneous. Because the force they exert on each other is based upon how far apart they are. As soon as I move it, instantaneously, right, they're going to have the force between them is going to be less. Right? Let's say they're a million miles away from each other. And then I go up to one and I move it a million and 1 miles. Right? As soon as I move it, instantaneously, they're going to be a different force. Because the force is a product of the distance between them. If the distance is greater, the force between them is greater. But it's instantaneous. Right? Makes sense? It's action. It's called action at a distance. Action at a distance means that each particle, each charged particle is exerting a force on each other across space instantaneously. Okay? This is an idea that nobody really liked. And Newton did not like it. You know, it was, I think Aristotle was not a big fan of it. Newton introduced it, reintroduced the idea, but he hated it. And the concept to really...
How could it be instantaneous?
Because you're saying that this particle A repels, or let's say attracts, particle B, right? And how much it attracts it is based upon how far apart they are. So if they're a million miles from each other...
But if you have one that's a million miles away from another one, but then you have one that's only 500,000 away from it.
Let's just take two. Let's just deal with two. I have two. A and B, right? And when they're a million miles apart.
It's not going to be at the same time if one's closer. If you have a third one that's closer, it's not. Those two are not going to be weakened.
Forget the third one. Let's just take two. I have A and B.
I'm questioning on
instantaneous. They're weakened at the same time.
What's that?
They are weakened at the same time.
What's between them?
Okay, fine. The case is simple. You have A and B. They're a million miles apart. The force they exert is 10. Okay? 10. They're repelling each other at a force of 10. 10 some units. Okay? It's 10. Then, if they're moved to 11, or a million and 1 miles, okay, immediately, as soon as they're a million and 1 miles, or moved an inch, the force is now 11, or whatever, it's less, rather, it's 9. It goes down to 9. It drops off. Right? Because the forces entirely go by distance. As the distance changes, it changes. Okay, fine. Fine. Now, the other way, what developed was a different way of looking at things, where where it's called the field way of looking at things, the field view, where I look at an electron, and I look at a single electron, a single particle. I'm not looking at another particle yet, just a single electron. And what I look at is I look at that it sends out the way the picture is. He sends out lines of force. Okay, but like if you can imagine, I think the picture is helpful, even describing the picture. If you mind, you imagine taking a little dot, calling that your electron A, and you draw lines that go away from the electron, okay? And those lines represent a field, okay? So if I were to draw four lines, right, in like a grid, right, a vertical and horizontal, that would represent, you know, a field of a certain strength. If I were to draw eight lines, like, you know, add the X to it, that would represent, you know, doubling the strength of the field. If I had 16 lines, it would be even stronger. And the direction the field points, whether the field the arrows point in or out, would show me whether it's a positive charge or a negative charge. Okay? But the idea is a single charge, it affects the space around it. Okay? Such that I can look at a space a million miles away from this charge, and I say, oh, it's produced a field of strength 10. Right? And I look at an area, piece of space that's 10 feet away from it, I say, oh, it's produced a field of strength 100. Okay, what does it mean to have a strength 100 field or strength 10? It means if I were to put another electron there, it would feel a force. Now, it would feel a force from the field itself. Okay, because the electron A has created a field. We'll call it the field of electron A. The field is everywhere in space. I go to everywhere in space, and I give a number to everywhere in space, and I say how strong that field is. So what that number means is, theoretically, right, it doesn't mean anything if I'm just putting a number there. Right, it's a theoretical number. It means if I were to put another electron, B, at that point in space, it would feel a certain force that strong in that direction. Okay, that's the idea of a field. A field means I take an electron A, and I define all the area around it by numbers and direction, which are theoretical ideas of, you know, there's a number and direction every point in space, and all that number means, if I were to get electron B and put it in that point, that number and direction tells me what force electron B would feel. Okay? So the way I look at it is not that electron A directly acts on electron B. I look at electron A creates a field, and the field it creates in all of space acts on electron B. Okay? And this is not action at a distance, because the field propagates and moves through space at the speed of light. It's not instantaneous. So when I move electron A, the effects of electron A, it takes time to reach electron B, because the field that it's producing has to travel. It travels through space. The effect of electron A on space around it, it's as the electron moves, the field around it moves and it changes and it takes time. So that's one of the major advantages of fields, is they're local. All the effects on electron B, that's the one that's, you know, gets affected by A, it's always local, because it's always that area of space, the field in that area of space is what's changed. And that's the field in that area, in that little space where electron B is, that's what acts upon it. So A affects the space around it, and that space, which is called the field of A, and that field of A acts on B when it gets there. Okay, go ahead.
What are lines of force?
Lines of force is just, it's like a descriptive way to look at it.
Okay.
It's just like in a picture way of looking at it. Maybe which does not helpful because I have no pictures here.
I can imagine lines radiating the affirmative.
Yeah. Lines radiating the affirmative.
But what, like...
They just describe... It's a pictorial way. Yeah, it's a conceptual way. It's a pictorial way of describing what I was saying mathematically, is that, like, there's a number and a direction. Because an arrow, a line has a direction. A field, not every field has a direction. The case of electron does. It has a certain strength. The further away you are, the weaker it is, meaning the weaker the number is. And the direction is away from the particle. It could be directed to the particle. It could also swirl. Magnetic field could swirl around. If you ever seen, like, pictures of, like, a magnet, the field around a magnet, you know, like the iron filings is kind of like in like a circular type of thing. So that's enough. That's the color lines of force. It doesn't have to be radial, away from the thing or to the thing.
So the question is the relationship itself that which produces the force, or is it the field and then just another electron comes and...
You're right. So the mechanical view like we did the first way, is that the two particles just act on each other based upon how far apart they are. The field view is to say that each electron, we'll look at A just to keep things simple, electron A creates a field. This field is everywhere in space, right? The further away in space you are from electron, the weaker the field is. The closer you are to electron, the stronger the field is. And what does a field mean to be strong or weak? It means, what does it mean, right? It means if another charged particle was put in the area of the field, it would feel a force. The stronger the field, the stronger the force. Okay? In which case, particle A is creating a field, and the field is acting on B. Right? The field mediates the interaction between the two charged particles. They don't directly interact with each other instantaneously. Rather, they interact over time as the field spreads out. Almost if I were to create a charged particle right now, the field around it would start to spread out, like in a ball in a sphere, and would get bigger and bigger, and it would go further and further at the speed of light.
It wouldn't be instantaneous.
It would not be instantaneous, right? The field propagates out from the charged particle as soon as the charged particle comes into existence, and it moves out like a sphere.
Why isn't it instantaneous everywhere?
Because it's not, because it takes time for the field to travel. Field travels the speed of light. Yeah, it really does. It travels the speed of light. Okay, and that's why it's local, yeah.
Is there a mamashus to this field with lines of force?
Oh, well, that's the question. Is there mamashus? Oh.
What do you mean mamashus?
Well, you said it takes time to travel. It makes it sound like there's made up a hit, which
that's the real question, okay? So
the electron itself is a particle.
Okay, the electron you say is a substance, right? Well, that was really the question. So originally, the field was just looked at as a practical way to keep track of things, like a simpler way to keep track of things mathematically. And it's just a mathematical tool for calculating things. Okay, right, but not an actual thing. Over time, they started to realize that you could look at the field like it is a real thing. Okay, and eventually...
Well, it's a real thing, or it is a real thing.
Well, that's the debate. Okay? I mean, most physicists will tell you it's a real thing. Okay? Fields are real. I mean, well, that's the issue. Okay, that's going to be the issue. What is real? Is the field a real thing in its own right? But, you know, you can associate the energy and the momentum can be associated with the field completely. You could look at the energy, I think, this has been years since I did this, but I think the energy of the charge, you could look at like it's in the charge, in the particle, or you can calculate it like it's spread out over all space in the field. Okay, so there's a way, so you can look at the field like and also light itself is nothing but a field. It is an electromagnetic field. A little more complicated. Photons. Well, photons is the particle way of looking at it. Okay, right, that's the other thing. Okay, fine. The classical way is, let's not get into this. We will get into it, but one step at a time. Okay? But yeah, that's the real question.
A question just for knowledge?
Yeah.
This field, is it infinite?
No. Nothing physical is infinite. It
doesn't go on forever. Or is it after a certain point in the...
Oh, well, no. In theory, it will go on. It will go on.
It will go on forever, yeah?
Yeah, right.
Oh, so it is infinite.
No, it's bounded by the universe, which is not infinite.
It will go on ad infinitum, but it's never going to reach a point in which it's infinite.
Limit. It keeps going. Yeah, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker until the point where it's practically.
Practically, it always gets like half reduced.
I mean, it falls off as you know the distance squared.
It's like zero.
There's complications to it. Also, if there's no other. Okay, we're not gonna.
It gets halfway weaker each time.
Okay, I don't want to get into the infinity thing. Infinities are a whole nother mess. Okay. Okay, good. Now let me read you from, this is from Einstein.
It's not like a voice where just after a while it stops. In other words, it goes for a really long time.
Oh, yeah. Really long time. In theory, it keeps going. In theory, it keeps going, okay. For sure.
And so, right, so this is a particulate matter, or it's like energy?
The field?
Yeah, energy?
The field has energy and momentum, yeah, it does.
So it's like on the electromagnetic spectrum?
Yeah, that's what electromagnetic wave is.
That's what it is.
That's what it is, yeah, a field. It's just a field. A field, okay? I mean, there's obviously complexities here. Okay, but there's two views. You see the two views? Okay. So I'm going to read from Einstein's page 151 in his book, Evolution of Physics. Okay? He's like this. The old mechanical view attempted to reduce all events in nature to forces acting between material particles. Okay, this is the mechanical view. Upon this mechanical view was based the first naive theory of electrical fluids. The field did not exist for the physicists of the early years of the 19th century. For him, only substance and its changes were real. Okay, substance meaning the particles and the changes in the particles. He tried to describe the action of two electric charges only by concepts referring directly to the two charges. Okay. In the beginning, the field concept was no more than a means of facilitating the understanding of phenomena from the mechanical point of view. It was just a helpful way of making calculations. In the new field language, it is the description of the field between the two charges, and not the charges themselves, which is essential for understanding other actions. Okay, but the new field language, the new way to view things, the field itself becomes more essential. The recognition of the new concepts grew steadily, until substance, meaning the particles, was overshadowed by the field. It was realized that something of great importance had happened in physics. A new reality was created, a new concept for which there was no place in the mechanical description. Slowly and by a struggle, the field concept established for itself a leading place in physics, has remained one of the basic physical concepts. The electromagnetic field is, for the modern physicist, as real as the chair in which he sits. Okay, so you have these two views, and now I want to just to describe. Okay, in physics, this split between the particle way of looking at it and the field way of looking at it, it followed through from classical physics, as Einstein's discussing. Classical physics is Newtonian's world and Maxwell electromagnetic fields, and into the quantum world. Okay, so this is in the 1940s. So the basic original quantum mechanics was in the 1920s, I believe. Okay, Schrodinger, Bohr, Heisenberg, Pauli, right? But in the 1940s, you had a reformulation of a more sophisticated formulation of quantum mechanics. And there was really two ways. Two ways it was originally done. One was Feynman. Okay, Feynman did it. And Feynman did it using a particle view of the world. Okay, have you ever seen Feynman diagrams? Anybody ever seen Feynman diagrams? No? Okay, Feynman diagrams basically is like little pictures of particles and squiggly lines between them. And basically particles, okay? And so it's a way of mathematical calculation, looking at the world of quantum mechanics like it's particles. Okay, it's a funny world, quantum mechanics, no matter what, but it's looking at particles. Then there's a competing view, which was Julius Schwinger, which was much more mathematical, formalistic approach, but it's looking at it in terms of fields. Okay, formulating quantum mechanics in terms of fields. Freeman Dyson is the one who realized that they're equivalent ways of viewing the world. That they're basically they're two different ways of viewing quantum mechanics, but they're essentially the same description. They could reduce one to the other. Mathematically, they're equal to each other. Okay, but this dualism, this way of viewing it, you could view the world as you could, and to this day it remains. Some physicists believe that the world essentially is made up of particles. Okay, and that's the way to view them: particles and their interactions. Now, more sophisticated in the old mechanical point of view. And some physicists view it as it's the whole world is made up of fields. Everything is really fields, and in that way, there's no such thing as really particles.
No one holds both exist.
Some people do that also. There's a way you can kind of they're both you need them both. They complement each other. You kind of need them both. Okay, but fundamental physics is sometimes described as particle physics. Person says they're a particle physicist, that means they work in fundamental physics, or it's a quantum field theory. Quantum field theory and particle physics are identical, and fundamental physics, all the same thing, there's no difference. Okay, but it's just two different terms. Quantum field theory and particle physics is just two terms for the same discipline, fundamental physics, high energy physics, it's all the same exact thing. Okay, but it's because there's these two different ways of looking at the world, as made up of fields, okay, and I don't look at, in the field point of view. What is the charge? Okay, let's start with that. That's the key point to transition back into the Tosos here. Okay. Okay, we're gonna try to get back to those. What is a charge? Okay, so in the old mechanical view, you say, look, there's these two particles. They have this property called charge that causes them to exert a force on each other. Okay, in the field view is a particle that has a charge. The charge is what makes this particle create a field around it, okay? But what is a charge from the framework of the field? What does the charge do for me? Okay?
Reduces the field.
Right, all I really care about is the fact that I say an electron makes a field. Right, it produces a field. And that field acts on other things. What does it mean to say that the electron has a charge? What is charge?
The type of field it's producing.
Right, well, charge, all a charge means is that a thing produces a field. You see, and charge is almost, it doesn't really mean anything other than that this electron makes a field around it, which will affect other things. What is charge? It's almost charge means, in a sense. If you think about it, charge means that this electron will affect another electron, or this electron will produce a field that will affect another electron. Okay? So on the one hand, I could look at it like this electron really has this thing called charge, and that charge is responsible for producing fields. Or I could look at the whole reality as basically the fields themselves, and I could do all my calculations with the fields interacting with each other. And as the fields change, they produce other fields. And even if I don't need to have charges, I could just say, well, let's keep particles, but just drop charge. But the particle, an electron, creates a field. That's what charge means. It means it creates a field. It doesn't really have charge. It just means it creates a field. Okay? That's, you understand, the two ways of looking at it. I could look at charge as it's a real thing, some real magical property called charge, and that charge creates a field. Or I just say, forget charge. All I really have is certain particles create fields, certain particles don't.
When you say the quality of creating fieldness is charge?
What is that?
That is that.
Is that a thing? Is that really a thing?
What do you mean by thing? I don't know.
Yeah. Is charge a real thing?
What do you mean real thing? It's not a physical thing.
Oh, well, then it's not real. That's what I mean. It's not physically real. It's a conceptual idea. You could say the charge. It might be helpful for you to think about it. But is it a physical thing? The physical thing is the field.
Right,
the electron makes a field. Now, does the electron have charge? Well, it makes a field.
Is the other way a physical property?
Yeah, you would say there's something, there's like really charge. There's something physically different about this electron than this electron is different from a neutral particle. Like a neutron doesn't produce a field, an electric field. So I'd say that this electron is physically different about it. And then this neutron, that's why it produces the field. Or you could say the physical difference is the fact that it produces a field. That is the physical difference.
It acts differently. What causes the field to be produced?
The electrons are causing it.
But no physical thing causes the field to be produced.
That is the difference. Now, you can make up this hypothetical thing, which doesn't really mean anything, called charge, and say, well, that's the thing that's causing it. But have you really gained anything by introducing this mythical quality called the charge?
Right. Well, you got the problem of causality.
Well, the question is, do you really gain anything by saying, all you really have is that one electron produces a field, or one electron acts on another electron? Does it really help you to say that the electron has a charge? Now, you could say that. There is a conceivable, it is a way of thinking about the world, that the electron has properties, and those properties are responsible for producing its effects. But on the other hand, you could just look at it as that all I really have is the effects, the actions of the electron, how it acts, how it interacts with other things.
Well, and what causes it to interact in that fashion?
Because it's an electron. Electrons
what
do.
About electrons causes that react in that fashion?
That's what they do.
I mean, what about it produces this phenomenon?
What about an electron makes it have a charge?
That's the equivalent thing that I'm saying.
Right. You haven't gained anything by saying, I just say this is what electrons do. They act in a certain way. They produce fields. This is what they do. Now you could say, well, the charge makes it go, well, what about what makes it have that charge? It just does. So once you're going to say, well, it just does have that charge, skip the charge, just say it just makes a field.
No, you can say things have things without pausing the reason. You can't say things do things without saying.
Why not?
I don't know. I feel that's true.
You're a particle guy.
Does a proton make a field?
Yes. As a positive charge.
Isn't it a different field than an electron field as opposed to a proton field?
They're actually the same, more or less the same field. But, like, there are other types of fields.
Where they're less the same field, that makes a difference.
You mean there's different types of fields?
You said they're more or less the same. Are they the same? If they're not the same, then they're different. So if they're different, then it's not just...
I don't know what you mean by different. I mean, they're different to a degree, yeah.
So then that's the difference here, right?
Right, because one's a proton, one's an electron. They do different things. They make different fields. What have you really gained by saying they have opposite charges? They just make different fields.
But that's the difference, isn't it?
What's the difference? The fields they make is different.
The field they make is different
right.
Because they're different.
Oh, Well, what's different about them? The fact that they make different fields. Well, the reason they, let's say, an electron and proton will attract each other is because they make different fields from each other. You don't understand? You don't have to say that they have different charges. You could just say they make different fields. And you could formulate all physics purely from the world of fields. You don't have to go in, you don't have to introduce does particles
every,
with charges.
Does every electron have the same,
yes.
Same
charge?
No, same
field?
Strength of field?
Yeah.
Every electron has the same.
Mm-hmm.
So what quality do you gain by positing a physical idea of charge?
It's a way to, you know, it is because, look, every electron has the same field around it. Every electron has the same mass, right, in terms of how it reacts in terms of a gravitational field. It has the same magnetic moment. It has, there's a lot, these properties, they all come together. So there is an idea of unifying them in the particle itself and saying there's these certain properties. It's a way of thinking about the world. That an electron has this property called charge.
Once you're already, why unify them in the property? Why not just unify them in the electron?
Yeah, because why call that a property?
Why, if you want to unify all these different phenomena that the electron produces to one thing, why do you want to unify it in a quality of the electron as opposed to saying they're unified in the electron itself?
Part of the definition of electron.
Yeah.
It's the definition of electron is that it has charge.
No, why that it has? Why not just that the definition of electron is that it produces these things? Why
produces the field?
Produces all the effects. Yeah, that you.
That's the other way.
Anything that a charge would produce. What do you gain by positing a charge? Meaning you're going to unify them in something either way.
Well, let's say I want to look at the world as just particles, no fields. So then I have to say charge, because I have to say this electron and this electron are interacting with each other. Why? Because they each have charges. If I'm not going to have fields, then I have to make it a property
fine,
electron
so if
itself.
If you don't have fields, then you need charges. But
yeah,
once
yeah.
you have fields, is there any point in positing charges?
You're... Right, but you could, as I say, Feynman is a way of formulating physics ultimately with just particles and their interactions.
And no charges.
No fields.
No fields, but charges.
Yeah, right.
Okay, but if you're going to say that there are fields, why would you posit charges?
Well, why would you? Right, I don't think you would.
Okay.
It doesn't really make sense. It's unnecessary.
So either you're a field guy or you're a charge guy.
Yeah, but I think there's an in-between. I don't know. I'm not sure. There is a way. It's the way is... We're going to get to it at the end, actually. Okay, I'll get to that the way. Yeah. At the end of this year. Okay, if we have time. We will. Okay, now I want to come back to the Tosfos. Okay?
Right, perfect segue.
Yeah. Okay, good. The point is hopefully, like I said, sometimes an analogy helps make an area clear. Okay? That's not this type of analogy. Okay? Right, correct. But sometimes the point of an analogy is just to show that there is an analogy, okay? And that's the thing, the value in the analogy itself. What's the value in that? It's because...
Are analogies subject to value like that?
Okay, ask me after I showed the analogy, and then you ask me why. Why do I care, okay? Okay, good. Okay, so like this. There's two ways you could look at chaloshemos, halacha of chaloshemos. One is I could look at a chaloshem of Isser Hana, okay, as it's a chaloshem, it redefines the object, okay, the object becomes Asabana. There's a chaloshem Isser Hana, devolves upon the object from the world of chaloshemos, right, where Plato, after he was a Megayer, now he's learning Torah, he's involved in the chaloshemos, and it comes from Plato's world right down to the object, chal, okay, chal on the object, okay, and now it redefines the object, okay, it's Asabana, okay. If that case, in l'chashina gadol mizu.
You're going back to...
Tosos. I'm back in Tosos now.
Oh, because not every chal Hashem is Hana. I mean, there's other things that...
Yeah. Fine. Chal Hashem Tumma. A chal Hashem is Rachila.
You're saying ad years or in here?
Chal Hashem Eishas
Ish. In here. Chal Hashem Eishas Ish. Yeah.
You're now specifying on this Tosos. Back in Tosos.
Back in Tosos.
Okay.
I mean, Meta Halacha now. Okay, Meta Halacha.
Is that a chal Hashem or that's just a shame?
Chaloshem. We're doing chaloshemos. Okay? Chaloshem eshes ish. Chaloshemos. You could look at chaloshemos as they're chal upon gavros, upon chefzes. They redefine the object. Okay? Or you can look at it as not the chaloshem, but there's certain dinim. Okay? What's the din? This truma, this pile of wheat, touched a sheretz. Okay? A dead rat. I don't know. Or a rat, rat's a sheretz, but a mole. Something like that. Okay? Touches the sheretz, okay? And now what happens? It's usher, you can't eat it. It has a din, it has a law that you can't eat it. Not that there's a chalo shame where the object has been redefined, but the interaction with the sherets on the pile of wheat has caused it to become now, it has a din, it has a property, a law, that you're not allowed to eat it. Okay? But not that the object became redefined as aser ba'achila, but rather it has a din in terms of its relationship to people that it can't be eaten. Okay? By Eishes Ish, you can look at it that there's a chaloshim Eishes Ish, or you look at it that there's an iser to the whole world, nobody else is allowed to sleep with her. That's what it means. Only the husband and not anybody else. Okay? So, say anybody the Yayin Nesach. Okay, you can look at it as a chaloshim Yayin Nesach. Or you could look, what does it really mean that something is aser b'hana? What does it mean? Does it mean anything other than there's a din that you can't be nana from it? There's a law you can't benefit from it, right? What do chaloshemos really even mean ultimately? Don't chaloshemos ultimately, in this way of viewing things, and arguably in any way, there has to be a nafkamina. There has to be a some result of the chaloshem. You can't really have an halacha chaloshem with no results, no effects, no dinim.
That's true.
I mean, the other side might argue, but yeah, I think so. I mean, what would it mean to have something be tame, but there's no nafkamina to it?
Strictly conceptual.
I could say it's not even tame. What would it be? And I argue, no, it's not tame. What's the difference?
You're wrong.
It's not a
different
condition.
That's a different
condition. Not a different condition, exactly. For example, I don't know if this might confuse. I'm trying to make an analogy really clear. But by Tumma, forget about it. Okay.
Let's do some more.
Yeah.
Some more analogies that make
confusing. Right. No, that'd be an analogy to help, and that would confuse. Okay. So I say there's two ways of looking at it. Is you could look at the chaloshem like it's the object is now aser b'hana. It's a different object. Or you could say no, the object is exactly the same as it was before. You're just not allowed to eat it. But there's nothing changed about the object. It's just the way people relate to it has changed, because it touched the sherets, because it was involved in a maisa of Yayin Nesach, of being poured out to Avodah Zarah. So now nobody's allowed to benefit from it. But if that's the case, has the object changed? Not at all. It's been totally external to it. It's the dinim, the laws that relate to the object. How people must treat the object has changed. Okay, or if a thing in terms of tumah, it affects whether if a thing, if what... If it touched something else, what the laws of that thing would be? Yeah.
This is a universal thing that we're saying, Arl Chalos Shemos, inherent in things or adherent to things?
Right, correct. Right now I'm saying very universal. Very universal question at this point.
Right, but I don't understand that, like, it seems some Chalos Shemos, when we talk about Chalos Shemos, in some instances, it can be an inherent property. So that it can be an adherent property. Why do you say it's one of
the... I'm saying you can, every area, you can look at it in these two ways. Every Chalos Shemos, you can look at it in these two ways. Is it chaloshem where it really changes the object? It really redefines the object from the chaloshem? Or is it, no, just the dinim, just the laws about that chaloshem or what's changed? And the chaloshem is just a helpful trick for you to keep in your mind to unify all the effects. But there's no real chaloshem. Nothing really has changed about the object. Sounds it's just like a nice mechanism for keeping track of changes. Give me an example where you're saying you have to have a chaloshem. It's got to be a real, where there's no, I can't just define in terms of its dinim, its laws.
Why? You don't say that, for example, a married or a woman doesn't always, you say there's an idea of ishish. If there's an idea of ishish, then what about the woman who's producing
the maisa kiddushin. The Maisa Kiddushin, right? There was an action that took place, a real event in space and time,
yeah.
Right? Haramikudeshously. And you did a Kenyan. So that Kenyan makes it that she's usher to everybody else. And she's Motor to you. So no Chaloshem Ishes Ish.
The Maisa produced Isra on that?
The Maisa created these Dinim, that she's usher to the world and she's Motor to you. She hasn't changed. But the Dinim, the laws with regards to her have changed. Now, if somebody else sleeps with her, you'll kill that person. That's all it really means. That's all that means. But he's going to kill him. You'll kill him too.
I'm saying it's the Maisa. No.
What?
I'm saying the Maisa caused it, not the woman.
Well, you're calling to everybody the Maisa caused, the Maisa Kiddushin. Well, even if you say Chaloshin, the Maisa Kiddushin produces
the
Chaloshin.
The Maisa caused the Isra or redefine the woman.
Right, exactly. Does the Maisa redefine the woman, and now Mimela, she's an Ashes Ish, and now nobody can sleep with her? Or do you say, no, the Maisa produced the very din of Isra?
What's the Nafkimi of what you're saying?
There's no nafkamina.
I thought you said everything that's done nafkamina is otherwise it's meaningless.
Oh, Well, there, here you go. Our sugya is a nafkamina. We're going to get to that. But in, just in general, there's two ways of looking at everything. Okay? It doesn't really matter. Okay?
Right.
It doesn't really matter. The nafkamina is this sugya. Hezik Shein Nikar and the Goslin case. Okay? Otherwise, I'd say there's just two different ways of looking at it. Whichever one you want to use, fine. Okay? But over here, you see there's a nafkamina to the thing. Is if I look at it as something external to the object, the dinim, but the object fundamentally is unaltered, and the chal shem is just a helpful mechanism for you to theoretically, it's a hypothetical idea that you use in your mind to try to formulate the halacha, but what's really changed in the world of halachic reality, what's really changed is just the dinim of the object. So then that's hezek shein nikar, lav shmei hezek. Nothing really has changed. You can't say the object has been damaged because it's the exact same object it was before. I, the dinim, have changed yet, but they're external to the object. It's like the field. The field has changed, but the object remains the same. Okay, the dinim of the object have changed, but the object is the same, and the gazan can say reshecha fanecha. But if you say that no, that the chaloshemos are real, and they inherit in the object, they redefine the object. So in l'chashina galdam yisur, it's a completely different object. It's been halachically redefined. Halachic reality says that this is a new object, this new chaloshem, it's been redefined. And therefore, you can't return that object. It's totally different. It's Tameh. It's Asa Bachila. Okay? And then Hezek Shein Nikar, Shmei Hezek. It is Nikar. What's more Nikar than that? Halacha recognizes it. Halacha recognizes halachic reality. If you say Hezek Shein Nikar, Shmei Hezek, it becomes Nikar. What does that mean? Because we're not blind to halachic reality. It's not halach only sees physical reality. Halacha is aware of halachic reality. The question is, what is halachic reality? If halachic reality is the Chal Hashemos, then it is Nikar. Completely Nikar. We know it's Tameh. We have Eidim. It's Tameh, and in the Chashina Galdomizu. But if you say halachic reality is in the dinim, so the object is fundamentally exactly the same physically and halachically. I, the dinim, are different, but so what? The object is the same, and lav shmei hezek. There's no damage, the object hasn't changed. Okay? And Harishah Chafanecha, the Gazan can return it. Okay? It's just taking that the first definition of whether the Chaloshem is inheres in the object itself or it's something external to it. And trying to take it to a little bit more meta-halachic question of what's halachic reality. Is halachic reality chaloshemos that redefines objects? Then I got to work in the world between chaloshemos and objects and people. But it's always I'm working with chaloshemos. Or they say, no, chaloshemos is a helpful mechanism for remembering dinim and for unifying dinim. But the real halachic reality is the dinim and the nafkaminas that result from these chaloshemos. But the chaloshemos themselves have no halachic reality. Okay, two ways of looking at it, and that creates a nafkamina vis-a-vis the sig of Hezek Shein Nikar, Shmei Hezek, La Shmei Hezek. Okay, and that's the Dvar Torah. Which one did the Torah choose? Okay, there's one more part to this year, but first I want to make sure this one's good. Yeah, go ahead, Yanko.
Which way do
we hold?
What?
Which way do we hold? We hold La Shmei Hezek. The field theory. Field theory, much more abstract, much better. Okay, but don't worry, we'll rescue it. We'll rescue it the other way.
It's less abstract.
It's all dinim. Oh, it's much more abstract. Chaloshemos is much more easy to work with. It's all dinim, man. There's no such thing as Eishes. It's just dinim. Chiv Misa.
I don't accept it.
Particle guy. You're particle guy. Okay, yeah.
I don't understand. So, if it really is different dinim, what is causing different dinim? Meaning, if they're all the same thing, then the same thing should produce the same dinim. Why are they producing
because
dinim?
The event... The event of the contact, the interaction between the sheretz and the truma, causes the truma to not be to be prohibited from being eaten, to have that din of Israel not to be able to eat it.
The event is over now.
Right, the event is over, but the din remains. There's a din on it.
Right,
you can't eat it, but it's not redefining the object.
It's really simple to go that direction.
It's just the din.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's just one less step. Instead of saying it redefines that, then what's causing
it? You're right.
It?
You're like, cut out the middleman. What do you need it for?
Yeah,
what do you need it for?
Yeah.
All that really, what reality does the Chaloshim have anyway? Just the din that's the real Allah Nafkamina. So cut out the, there's no such thing as Tumah. What does Tumah mean? It means you're not allowed to eat it. Or it means if it's something else touches, you're not allowed to eat that thing.
Right.
Or you're not allowed to bring it into Beis HaMikdash. I mean, Tumah always means Nafkamina, so it means dinim. Right, either with this object or something else that touches it, or something else that touches that thing that touches it. Right, so we'll just work with the dinim are the only thing that are real. The laws are the only thing that are real. The halashim will help you keep track of dinim. But what are the what's the halachic reality? Does the halachic reality reside in the halashimos, or does it reside in the dinim? Okay, so lechora you could have said that's the machlokas. between the two shitas, Chizki and Rabbi Yochanan. And Dvar Torah, what's the, normally you could do what doesn't really make a difference. Over here in the sugi, you have a nafkamina. And Daraisa, what's the way that the Torah really looks at it? Okay. So I don't think that's the machokas. Okay, you could say that, but that's a very big machokas. Okay, I don't think that's, and that's a really, it's a big machokas, okay?
Do they take out these kind of machokas with us?
What?
Do they take out these kind of machokas?
Only when I'm learning the sugya, no. Okay. Okay.
What about Mishnahs?
What?
What about Mishnahs?
What about Mishnahs?
That's nine. Had more like universal machokas.
But this is a very, it's, that's what it's called, it's a meta-halachic question. It's a meta-halachic question, it's about the nature of the halachic reality. This is not a normal definition.
Do they ever take this kind of thing
out? Who's they?
The great men of our past.
I've heard Rebbe give meta-halachic svaras.
Anyone before him?
Not common though, but he has. I didn't coin the term. Rebbe, as far as I know, Rebbe coined it.
Rav Chaim of Brisk.
Rav Chaim, no.
The field didn't exist.
The field of metallurgic research.
I'm gonna
say Rebbe pioneered it. Okay, you've been a Rebbe giving metallurgic svaras, no? You've heard it. How he vouches for me. Okay, they're not common. Okay,
it's an extension of field theory.
It's extension of field, no doubt. That's the parallel. Okay, so that's what I'm saying, because it's not a normal Brisker definition. That you don't do this at home. Okay, it's a question of what's the nature of halachic reality. That's what I call metahalach. It's a metahalachic question. It's meta. Right, you understand that you're going to what's the nature of halachic reality. It's not accepting halachic reality for whatever it is and then just defining, you know, what we did last week, how you define Nezek. Is Nezek evaluated by physical change? Is it defined by the diminution of its value? That's a halachic definition. Right, this you're trying to understand, are haloshemos halachically real or are the dinim halachically real? That's not a normal svara. Okay, but I say like this, is that I think that both ways of viewing halacha are legitimate. And I think both Chizki and Rabbi Yochanan agree that Doraisa, they're both legitimate ways to view the world. They're in a certain sense, they're mutually exclusive. You can't simultaneously view it that the reality is the dinim and not Hashem or Chal Hashemos, or the Chal Hashemos and not the dinim just follow from the Chal Hashemos. They're two different ways of looking at it, but they're both equally legitimate ways to conceptualize the halacha. Okay, they're complementary. Okay, you can view it either way. And I don't think why the Torah should be biased one way or the other. Okay, I think they're both equally legitimate ways to view halacha. And sometimes it's much more convenient to view a halacha in one framework as opposed to another one. Right, in Tumah, it's much more convenient to view in terms of Chal HaShemos. Right, this thing is an Avatumah, then it makes a Rishon, then it makes a Sheni and a Shlishi. Right, and now there's dinim, right? Shlishi truma is possible, but chulin is nothing, right? There's dinim that follow from that, but it's much more convenient to work in terms of tuma, let's say in terms of chal hashemos. At least I find that way. And hold on, let me just give that example. And in terms of kal v'chomers, when you're dealing with kal v'chomers is exclusively, it seems to me, you're working in terms of the dinim, right? If I say this is a kal, this is a chomer, right? This is metame be'ohel, and this is not metame be'ohel. Kal v'chomer. By mace from the vela. So if you look at every time you see a kavachomer in halacha, it's something strange. You always see it in kavachomers. You always say, why can't I say the reason this has this special chomer is because of some qualitative idea about that thing? And who, just because it's more chomer, you know, A is more chomer than B, who's to say that it should necessarily, the chomer of B should transfer to A? Okay, you have to, you can ask qualitative questions of kavachomers, but the answer is kavachomers are working in the framework of dinim. The logic of kavachomer doesn't look at chal hashemos, it doesn't look at the essence of the thing. It purely works in terms of the dinim, and it measures up dinim against each other, and there's a certain logic that applies if you ignore the underlying chal hashemos, and you completely ignore them and just look at the dinim between two different areas. And when I compare the two, I have the right to use kavachomer logic. Okay? But if I were looking in terms of chal hashemos, it's nonsensical. In terms of qualities, the whole logic of kavachomer doesn't really make any sense.
Why not?
Because I could always say that the reason why this is the kavachomer I've been, you know, is I don't want to give a kavachomer before I'm going to give the one that's in my head. I think of one that.
I think the one's in your head is good enough.
Okay, we'll use that one. Is the Rambam derives that a mace, a dead body, is metame b'masa if you pick it up. It's metame from the fact that a nevela, dead animal, right, it can become tame. You can become tame if you touch the animal or if you pick it up, but not if you're in the same room with the animal. No ohel. But a dead body, the Torah says if you touch it, you become tummy, and if you're in the same room with it, you become tummy. Okay, but it doesn't say anything about whether you pick it up or not. So the Rambam just says there's a kavachoma here, right? A dead body is metame b'ohel if you're in the same room. An animal is not metame if you're in the same room with it, right? So now, but an animal is metame if you pick it up. Kavachomer, right? A body is metame if you pick it up.
Could you do the opposite direction?
Yeah. Could you say the animal?
No, you're saying why he's meaning masa when it's...
So one of them gets din like masa, one gets din ohel.
How
have
you
proved
all kavachomers you can?
What?
How did you prove all
kavachomer? It's a chumrah. And it could you? It's a good question. I hear your question. It's a good question.
No, but this is a little different. This is saying you have two out of three.
And prove the other one's matam ohel?
Yeah.
I know. I like the question. It's a good question. Excellent question. I guess you would have to know that it's not matam b'masa, the mace. But you must know that the nevela is not matam ohel. Perhaps you know that. Okay. So, but the question is, you could say, no, maybe the reason a dead animal is matam b'masa has something to do with the fact of an animal. When an animal, when you pick up an animal, you relate to it in a certain way. But a human body, you don't relate to it in that way. You could just break it down that way. Why can't you say, like, this is something qualitatively about a dead animal that generates a tumah of carrying? In a dead body, a human body, is when you're in the same room with it, and each one is a qualitative idea. Why each one applies to each one? What right do you have? You could always say that by Kavah Homer. It's always some qualitative idea about that area that generates that din. And what right do I have to compare these areas? But the answer is because you're ignoring the qualities. You're just looking purely in the framework of dinim, and you're comparing things.
Okay. I mean, if the dinim of this are weaker here, then so much more the dinim of the stronger thing should be that way. What is the idea of kalkomer that part of the dinim?
As it work, when I have A, if I see A is more chumra in general than B, so then if B has a specific chumra, some stringency, it must exist in A also.
You have to know in advance that A is more chomer.
Yeah, you have to set up where you know that A is more chomer than B. I establish that A is more chomer than B because of some din that A has that B does not. And then I show a chomer of B and I say it must apply to A also. Because A is more chomer than B. And if B has that chomer, A must have it also. That's how kavachomer
right,
logic.
That doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't really make sense. It's not. It's a kavachomer logic. It's a logic only in its own realm. But it makes sense because it makes sense if you ignore the underlying qualities of each area. You're just working in dinim. And then you say, well, there's this logical system. It doesn't make sense if in the dinim are different. You're ignoring the chaloshemas, the qualities behind it. You're just purely looking in terms of dinim. Okay. But I still think whenever you're doing different areas, sometimes it's helpful to view it in terms of the dinim. Sometimes it's helpful to view it in terms of chaloshemas. I think there are different ways of looking at different areas. And when you're defining different sugyas, your terminology will vary. The way you conceptually formulate one area will vary. There are different ways of viewing it, and they're both useful and they're both helpful. And even though I could view tumah all in terms of dinim, I could. It's awkward. It's not smooth. You could do it. It's not smooth. Okay? And conceptually, the way to formulate it is to think about it is in terms of chaloshim tumas, things like that. So I think the Torah is aware of that. And I think the Torah advocates and endorses both worldviews, both views of halachic reality. They complement each other. They work well together. Okay? It's just that in this area, the two views give contradictory answers. Okay? The way looking at the Chal Shemos is real is going to give you Hezek Sheneker, Shmei Hezek. But if you say the Chal Shemos are not the reality and the Dinim are the reality, then you say Lav Shmei Hezek. So in this area, you end up with a Nafkamina. They give contradictory results. Okay? They don't just give two different ways of viewing the same thing, but they give contradictory results. And therefore, the Torah is forced to choose which you have to resolve the contradiction, and you have to give me one answer. And the machlokas is, how did the Torah resolve it? There are two ways, in general, to view the halacha. Usually you don't have to choose. You can go back and forth between the two. You can choose which one's more comfortable, depending on the area. This is, they give contradictory nafkamnias lahalacha. And therefore, Dvar Torah, the machlokas Chizki and Yerub Yochanan, is, how did the Torah, where did the Torah choose? When it was forced to choose between one or the other, in a halachic expression, which one did it choose? Okay? But not that neither one is really superior or has a greater reality view than the other. I say Rabbi Yochanan and Chizkiya both agree that Dvar Torah, they're both legitimate ways of viewing halacha. Okay? The machlokas is which one, when the Torah is forced to choose one, which one did it choose in a particular instance? You're saying the sugya of Hezek Sheniker forced the Torah in the sugya of Hezek Sheniker. In this sugya, when I have a halachic nafkamina in this question, it forced it, because there's a nafkamina of Hezesh Nikra and the Goslin, it forced the Torah to resolve it halacha l'maisa. But in the world, the conceptual world of halacha, they're both, I say, equal. They're both conceptually equal ways and equally valid ways to view the Torah, to view the world of halacha. Okay, it's just that because there becomes a halachic nafkamina, in the case of does a halachic chal Hashem change the object vis-a-vis Hezek Shein Nikir and vis-a-vis Gazlan, Heshachal Fanecha, you become forced to you know, the duality collapses in a sense, and you're forced to choose one way or the other.
So how could they possibly take a side on these kind of matters?
Because halacha is a practical system, and it's forced to take a side.
On the flipping a coin, how does one take a side on this kind of
thing? Oh, God chooses. How do they argue? That's a different question. I mean, what is Chizkiya base his? What is he saying that the Torah chose this way, and then Rabbi Yochanan says the Torah chose the other way? That's a different question. I mean, how do you go further than Machlokas?
Right. You see both sides, and that's it. Okay, we're done.
There's two possibilities, right? Flipping a coin, right? So God chose, and how the Torah chose? It's, I think that's further, and I have a possible way to take it further, but it's much more involved in the sugi itself. Okay, it has to do with what?
Will we be going there or no?
No, that's like a real. If it was morning shir, if this is morning shir, we would spend it. Because the Gemara, it's a long, it's, you know, there's a real sugi here. Is it Derabanan? And it gets into Kone Shogayatu Mezid. What's the Derabanan? Remember we discussed the Derabanans? Mm-hmm. So the how you reserve the Deraisa affects the Derabanans. You can possibly infer the Deraisa from the Derabanan. You might have a problem with that because of Rameir. So that's like a real getting into the sugi. And I don't have a real way to. I have a approach to working it out, but it has a problem, and it just, I started working it out and just realized this is not morning shir, and there's no way I could get into that, so I stopped. Okay, but it's, which way the Torah, I think only God ultimately can decide which way you resolve it. There's two logical ways of resolving it. God chose one or the other, and they're arguing which way did God choose, and how they infer what God chose, that's, I say, the Machlokas. They're trying to infer what God did, how did he choose. But they're both logical, they both agree, both views of Allah are equally legitimate. They both use them when they're defining halacha. And the question is, when you have to force to resolve it l'maisa, which way did the Torah resolve it l'maisa? Because they're contradictory. Yeah, Yaakov? You just had it before.
This is something that...
Go ahead. Yeah. You're next. Go.
You said that like it chooses the one that's more convenient. What do you mean by that?
I just think conceptually, one way is often smoother in a particular area to think about things, to formulate things. You know, I think it could depend on your personality. Not personality is not the right word, but your intellectual personality, so to speak. Which categories, which way of thinking about the world you're more comfortable with? Some people think more in terms of halacha. Some people think more in terms of dinim. Just like in physics, you know, there's really equivalent ways of viewing, of formulating things. Feynman came to a particle way of looking at the world. Schwinger came to a field way of looking at the world. And Dyson showed that they're equivalent. There's no real, they're a hainu hach, but they're completely different pictures of the world. Okay, but they're, you know, different minds have a tendency to view things differently. That's for sure. That's one factor. The other factor is certain things, certain areas are make more sense intuitively in one way of looking. Like the two double slit experiment makes more sense in a field way part of view, and you know, field view, in a particle view, it's much more difficult to understand. You know, so. Different areas of halacha will be, you'll find, it's even the yosi of your personal intellectual predilection, what makes you more comfortable in doing. But then certain areas will be just easier and smoother to formulate, it'll be awkward to formulate it in terms of dinim. In certain areas, even one of you in terms of chaloshemos, and that's the real, and the dinim are just consequences of the chaloshemos. But like I said, there's certain areas where the chaloshemos, what do they really mean? Does it really make any sense to even posit chaloshemos? The real thing is the din over here. What's the nafkamina, and it'll be easier to work with the dinim and ignore the chal shemos to some degree. Yeah.
It has to be that there's actually one Torah idea, though. It's not actually simultaneously using both of them.
No, I'm saying elu ve'elu. Elu ve'elu devar elokim chayim. They're both, halachically, they're both halachically real. Conceptual ways of viewing, in the meta-halachic realm, they're both conceptually equal, and you can think... And they're in, and I'm saying you can go back and forth between the two of them.
Right, but only one of them is really in the system.
Yeah, we have to paskin. There's a psak.
Right.
Yes, and there has to be one.
The emotion only got one of them.
I'm saying Moshe got both ways of analyzing halacha, and he got one in terms of halacha l'maisa. That's a. I don't want to get into Moshe got. That's a whole other can of worms. But let's just say the simple way of looking at things. Yeah, the simple way of looking at things. Moshe got one l'maisa. We don't know which one it was. That's the machlokas. Which one did he get? Right. Which one did God tell him? But that's even when God told it to him. I'm saying he told him l'maisa. Vis-a-vis hezek shein ha-nikar, vis-a-vis harei shechal fanecha. But not in terms of the meta-halachic way of looking at halacha. There's just, there the machlokis is novea from the fact that there's just two equal ways of formulating halacha. Just like there's two equal ways of formulating the physical reality. Using our minds, we can conceptualize physical reality in two different ways, as particles or as fields. What is physical reality? It's something other. But this is how we think about it. And we have two different wonderful worldviews, which are different from each other, but they're equivalent, and they're both trying to approximate a picture of underlying physical reality. Our conceptual apparatus has the particle view and the field view. Again, those are two ways of modeling and representing the underlying physical reality. The same thing, God gave one halachic reality, but our minds conceive of it in two ways. Chaloshemos or dinim, and you could formulate it equally well in the two different ways. Okay, what is it really? It's like asking, what is physical reality really? There's two ways we have of conceptualizing it. There's two ways we have of thinking about halachic reality, what it is. Okay, but those two ways give contradictory answers in this sugya, and that's where you're forced to argue dvar Torah, hezek shenik shmehezek lashme hezek. It becomes a nafkamina. Ein lecha shine gadol mizil, or there's no shine whatsoever, because of the two different worldviews. It's the shaila of hezek shein hanikar forces you to resolve it one way or the other. Okay, but they're complementary ways of viewing the world, and only the particular shailas force the halacha to resolve and to choose a side. Now, which way it chose, only God knows, and we can try to infer how he did it. But I that's what I'm saying. I don't think it's a real machlokas of what's the real halachic reality. I think in terms of the conceptual abstract framework, they're both legitimate ways of approximating the real halachic reality, which is neither. It's something, it's God-made. Which brings me back to your other question, Yaakov. Okay, well, why am I making an analogy between physics and between halacha? Okay, so I say the point is, I want to show you that this is one particular area, but the categories that you use in halacha are applicable in physics, and categories of physics are applicable in halacha. Okay, because they both come from the same source. They both come from the same creator. God, who created the universe, the physical universe, he created the world of halacha. Okay, and he's a genius. He's very smart. Okay, and he makes very abstract structures. Okay, and you can see the patterns of his work. You could see from one area of halacha to another area of halacha, one area of physics to another area of physics, and from halacha and physics, there are parallel structures and certain categories that can cross over, okay, between the two areas. And I think there's value in the analogy itself in seeing, when you could see categories you could see in the world of physics and the world of halacha, and you see there's analogs between them, analogs in different categorical divisions and chakiras and then structures. That itself, the analogy itself is an idea. You understand that two areas have similar structures shows you that there's a unification between the two. They come from the same source. So there's value in the analogy itself, not simply to illuminate each area, but just to show that there are parallels between these two areas, shows you something, that there's a relationship between the two. Okay, and the relationship is that ultimately, at the very least, they are the same creator. Maybe more, but at the very least, you know, maybe more. But I'm saying that there's value in showing the analogy itself between halacha and physics is the point in the shir to some degree. Okay, it's one of the main points. Okay, not because physics is going to help us understand the halacha, or halacha is going to help us understand the physics, but because just seeing that they parallel each other and the same structures itself is an interesting idea. Okay.
So the whole shir is really just one example.
What do you mean?
Of the,
so what do you mean?
It's from the same creator.
That what?
It's from the same creator.
It's all from the same creator, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. That's the idea. Okay. Okay, good. Any other questions? Or it's all super clear?
Super clear.
Super clear? I see you following completely.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. Okay, fine.